To quote Richard Lewontin, a 1900s mid-century American evolutionary biologist, we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. Well, Richard, I believe that divine foot has been propping the door open since before the time of Jesus. And Quantum Spirituality, a book written by today's guest, Peter Canova, dives right through that door to draw many known and unknown commonalities between science and spirit, potentially widening this path we are all on in this life. I'm Robin. Join us for Tributaries. Peter, let's start with Gnosticism and why your book, Quantum Spirituality, focuses on that particular wisdom.
Yeah, out of all the ancient spiritual traditions, I found the Gnostics to be the most scientific in terms of what the modern mind, or how the modern mind would perceive that word, because the Gnostics were the confluence of many different spiritual streams, Buddhism, Hinduism, Egyptian Hermeticism, the Jewish Kabbalah, and even Hellenistic mysteries, because they were kind of at the center of the intellectual universe at that time, which was Alexandria, Egypt, where all these different influences were kind of floating around. So when I read the Gnostic text, having a basic background in quantum physics, I realized that these texts were describing in non-technical terms almost every major theory of quantum physics, for, such as the Big Bang, parallel universes, the God particle, even Einstein's E equals MC squared. And I was really astonished at the parallels. Really, I said, okay, I did all this research, and incidentally, the nexus between the spiritual traditions and quantum physics is that they both deal with three basic things, which is light, matter, and energy. And that is really the basis for reality. Those three things are the basis for reality as we know it and we perceive it. And both Gnosticism and quantum physics zero in on these things in a way that they overlap to a remarkable degree. So that's how I zeroed in or focused on Gnosticism as opposed to maybe some other traditions.
And you certainly brought up the perennial philosophies of all of these religions and philosophies from time immemorial, really. And physics has its own technical speak or language. The Gnostic writings, how easily are they understood today? And I'm not talking what language they're written in, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand. You really have to have a basic background in Gnosticism, or kind of a scholarly background in it, because they were speaking of symbologies and using terms that would not be understandable in the modern mind. So you kind of have to dig back in history and say, okay, well, what did they mean at the time that they wrote this? And that required some years of study in order to do that. Once you do that, however, and you really understand that, you really realize they were speaking in these mystical or mystical terms and describing so many aspects of modern phenomena that are recognized in science today. But a bold reading, a naked reading of them by somebody who didn't have this background, it would be pretty tough to make it intelligible for most people.
Can you give an example of that comparison that you were just speaking of?
They used a lot of Greek terms, like the hypostasis of the archons. What does that mean, hypostasis of the archons? It means the reality of the rulers. And what they were speaking of, rulers, they were speaking of what I call the force of opposition, which is the sort of negative forces that impact human existence. And those forces were present really in the story from probably the very creation of the universe. There was a force of opposition, and what it really had to do with was individuality, okay? They started off with a proposition that there was one supreme force or consciousness, but there was also a force of opposition to that, and the force of opposition allowed for spirits to make a choice whether they wanted to sort of stay within the orbit of the, you know, divine unity. I guess what Christians would say, staying close to the throne of God, or to go off on their own journey of individual experience and kind of break off from the hive and go on a journey of individual experience. That journey of individual experience led to some unusual things. For one thing, the consciousness of spirit went through a number of falls or degradations or limitations that led to the creation of what we would call parallel universes today, culminating in the lowest level, which would be spiritual energy in physical form, and that's the world that we perceive as our reality today. But it was this force of opposition that allowed for these spirits to make a choice to break away from the spiritual unity and pursue an individual course of action. It was this force of opposition that was tied in with free will, the exercise of free will that said, okay, I'm giving you the choice that you can go off on your own and you can experience these things and thinking of yourself as an individual as opposed to, you know, understanding yourself as part of the unity. We always are part of the unity, so if we think of ourselves as individuals, it's really kind of a form of illusion. This hypothesis of the Archons had to do with this whole force of opposition, and if you just read it in a bold-faced kind of way, you would take this Greek term and say, well, what does that mean? In English, it's translated as the reality of the rulers, but who are the rulers? What it's really symbolizing is a choice that we all had to make, whether we were going to pursue the appearance of individual existence or stay within a spiritual plane of unity. And that's where kind of one example where people would just get lost by looking at the terms that they use in the Gnostic Gospels.
Sure. Right now, the world is becoming more vocal and more focused into spirit. And what does that mean? And looking at the dualistic life that most people live these days, you write that the spiritual truth needs a common ground in the multidisciplinary information venues. Does that keep us grounded? I think in a way it might keep us grounded in that dualism that's going on in the world.
I think ultimately it transcends dualism. And what I mean by taking a multidisciplinary approach really is it's kind of a roadmap. What quantum spirituality is, what the book is all about, is it's kind of a roadmap to help people have extraordinary experiences with higher consciousness. And instead of taking an approach of just quantum physics in isolation or reading spiritual texts in isolation, it connects the dots. And using, you know, Jungian depth psychology, neurobiology, quantum science, and ancient spiritual traditions, and showing where they overlap and where they're pointing to the same thing. And the same thing ultimately transcends duality, because the same thing gets back to the fact that the universe really is a unity in reality. It's a duality only in appearance. And if you really follow the trails of these individual disciplines, and again, remember, ultimately, they all lead to light, energy, and matter, and the interplay of those things and how they form the fabric of the universe, and how we go from essentially a singularity to a multiplicity or the appearance of duality. That's the story behind the whole thing. So I believe that taking those approaches ultimately doesn't reinforce our sense of duality. It actually leads us to have a better understanding of the fact that we're really, you know, a holistic or singularity.
How do you see our human collective coming out of these divisions?
Well, I think the answer to the question is we come out of it one person at a time, because everybody is pursuing an individual path. And I think the collective is really the sum of its parts, and the parts really have to change their perspective. And, you know, eventually you reach a point of critical mass where I think the collective as a whole begins to be moved in a different direction. I know in a way that's a little bit depressing to hear, because you wish that, you know, things would happen quicker, but I don't think it really works that way. In the Gnostic Gospels, really what they're really saying is, you know, it's really enlightenment really comes at the one person at a time, and then eventually it does reach a critical mass or sort of like a tipping point where it becomes more apparent and more generally transformative, this whole push towards a higher consciousness. What does that really tell us? It tells us that each person has to take responsibility for their own spiritual growth. Spirituality is just like anything else. It's work. It doesn't just fall into your lap. You have to have the desire. You have to have certain other factors involved that I think push you towards wanting to have a greater understanding of the world. And then eventually you have to take action to get there. So in the context of my work, I would say quantum spirituality is a great framework. It's a roadmap, okay? But like any roadmap, it needs more than one coordinate. It has to have a north and south, a latitude and a longitude in order to make sense. So this multidisciplinary approach that I'm taking that involves psychology, biology, quantum science, spirituality, and everything else, it provides a great arena or signposts for people, but the people have to take advantage of that by making a commitment to embark on their own spiritual journey. And it's like I say, people can live in the basement or they can move up to the penthouse. If you're in the basement, you know, you can get by. You have a job, you have a family, you know, you go to the movies, you do, you know, you lead your life, but that's not really the full panorama of life. If you really want to get the full perspective on what reality is about, you move up to the penthouse, and that means moving up in consciousness. That means making a commitment to wanting to understand more than what is apparent, more than the five senses. You know, you sense that there's something else out there. There's other dimensions of consciousness. There's other dimensions of existence that if we can tap into those, we can bring back valuable information that helps us out in the world here. And really, that's the essence of shamanism. 12,000 years ago in the shamanic age, the shamans were those guys that went over to other dimensions and they brought back information in order to help heal and guide people here to a better course in life.
Right. You just mentioned critical mass. I think that we would be surprised. I don't think every human being has to become completely conscious in order for things to take a significant turn toward unity. Do you have any thoughts about that?
I think that if you look at critical mass, you say, oh my God, it'll take millions of years for humans to, you know, to get there. Well, not really. When you really think about where we were and where we've come in a matter of 100,000 years, 50,000 years or whatever, it's really quite remarkable. And I don't just mean in technical terms, in scientific terms. Yeah, sure, we're better off materially than we were. But like you said, I think the better off we are materially, the more time we have to devote to understanding more abstract matters like consciousness, as opposed to just, you know, merely trying to survive. So I think that we have to take a long-term view of this, but I think humanity has made, you know, remarkable strides in a better understanding of how the world works today. I mean, I think there's a pop culture sense that, you know, there is a, quote, force, unquote, out there that has something to do with the guiding hand, you know, making the universe an intelligible place. I think there's much more widespread recognition of that than there was, you know, even a few hundred years ago. A few hundred years ago, our understanding is mostly would have been religious. But I think there's a move away from religious dogma, a confining view of things. It's sort of like, okay, you know, we're telling you how it is, and this is how it is, and it's mostly been negative. I think there's a move away from that towards a more free-thinking, spiritual understanding of forces in the world. And when you're talking about consciousness and critical mass, it's a spiral. It's not like we make this quantum leap in one or two or three generations, but it's a spiral. So sometimes it appears like we're not really moving anywhere, but in actuality, we are moving upwards in this spiral type of direction rather than, you know, looking at it like directly climbing a ladder. If you look at it from that point of view, it seems like we got a long way to go.
Yes, that religious dogma is getting replaced by the desire to have the experience that we all want individually. That is what is starting to override, I think, all of the dogma, because people are seeing that the dogma, whether it's religious or science or corporate or governmental, it's not going to fly anymore.
Yeah, I think there's two kinds of trends here. Some people clearly are going back into the comforting blanket of religion, you know, like, say, fundamentalism. Other people are becoming secular. I wouldn't say that that's any better than traditional religion. But I also think that there's a larger segment of people that, like you just said, are looking for free exploration or free expression to find what it means to be spiritual. And I think that's out of the three segments, I think that's probably more of a growing segment around the world. And that's really good, because the difference between spirituality and religion is, if you picture yourself on a journey of consciousness, to raise your consciousness, and you're on that path, religion says, okay, you stop off at this way station called religion, and they say, okay, come on inside our box, and, you know, if you sort of accept our dogma or our party line, we'll tell you how it is. And it's kind of a closed experience. The spiritual way station, though, says, hey, come on in and pick up some knowledge there, but then you go out the other door, you're free to go out the other door onto the next way station. So it's an open-ended exploration of consciousness rather than an attempt to box you in and tell you consciousness is this way or that way, or God is this way or that way. So I think there's more people that probably fall into that category of free spiritual exploration than those that are, you know, sort of clinging on to traditional religion, or on the other hand, have gone, you know, sort of in a secular way that is not really believing that any of these things are possible.
Yes, and all of us, I think, end up speaking about the mystics of old, and mystics have never left us on this planet. They're in every age, don't you think?
I do. It's probably not as apparent now because people are a little bit more skeptical. And I think religion had a lot to do with that. The problem with religion is that prophets speak the heart of God or the heart of spirit. Their followers start religions because their followers don't have the inspirational experience. So consequently, all these agendas start to get piled on to the original revelations. And then before you know it, we have people that are trying to interpret those new interpretations, and you're starting to build up a hierarchy. And essentially, that's happened to almost every religion on Earth. But at the central core of those religions were some beautiful revelations before they started to get systematized and dogmatized. I think that what I try to do in quantum spirituality is to say to everybody, well, you need to become your own prophet. You need to have a direct experience with higher consciousness. And that's what my book tries to do, is to give the knowledge and the tools to help on their journey to higher consciousness. But they have to make the commitment. They have to take the responsibility for their own spiritual growth, because I can't do that for them. You can't do that for them. But what we can do is provide signposts and provide points of knowledge that they can use to inspire them and further their exploration and get them to thinking and open their minds so that they can be receptive to spiritual input. That's what people like me or people like yourself can do to help other people who are willing to take the responsibility to move towards that direction.
Right. Now, speaking about the shaman, taking a step back here for a moment, I know you had the experience where almost spontaneously, or perhaps completely spontaneously, you realized you were a medical intuitive. So you were tapping into that. You didn't go to school. You didn't study, I want to be a medical intuitive. You didn't have a mantra every night doing that. It was just something that happened. So I'm curious, what did that do to your thoughts about healing?
Well, I think that what happened was when my rational mind took a back seat and didn't interfere with my intuitive mind in terms of finding out that I was an accurate medical intuitive, it opened up a whole spectrum of reality for me, where I started to experience clairvoyance, clairaudience, premonitions, remote viewing, and things of that sort. And I just let that happen. The whole thing was my rational mind letting that happen without questioning it to death and killing it. But then the funny thing about it was, after I started having all those experiences, after a point of time, being the Capricorn that I am, I did want to understand the nuts and bolts behind it. And that's when I started looking into spirituality, and then it led me into quantum physics and depth psychology and all, you know, things of that sort. So, you know, both the right brain and the left brain were really at play here. That's how it happened with me. Now, I think with a lot of other people, to get to the point where they have that kind of contact with higher consciousness, I think the majority of people, perhaps, it's more painful. They have to get to the point where they're just so beaten down by life, or, you know, overwhelmed, that they make a survival choice and they say, hey, listen, I've got to look at another way to live,
right,
and do
yes.
things and understand things. And then that desire born of maybe survival
the wounded healer
propelled on to a spiritual path. Now, some of them, like I say, they may become born again Christians, but a lot of people, you know, start an exploration of spirit. People come to this through all different doors. There's no universal way that you come to an understanding of higher consciousness or contact with higher consciousness. I guess there's probably as many paths as there are individual people. But mine was of a more like spontaneous variety, as you said. And what it showed me was, it showed me what we think of reality as an illusion. It's really a virtual or simulated reality of our own making, and that there are higher levels of our being, even each one of us has a higher consciousness out there somewhere. And oftentimes when we talk about raising spiritual awareness, what we're talking about is having a conversation with our higher selves. And it shows me that there are other dimensions of existence out there besides this one. And that becomes an experiential reality for me. So the best way I can analogize that is by saying, I can sit there and tell you all day that fire burns. But honestly, you don't know that for a fact until you stick your hand in the fire. Once you stick your hand in the fire, you own it. You know what the character of that is. And it's the same thing with spirituality. Once you've experienced these dimensions of existence and the information that comes from them, and you see that information validated in our so-called material world, you own that belief. I mean, it becomes as real to you as the conversation we're having right now.
In your book, you talk about different levels of consciousness or subconscious, and certainly Jung did a lifetime of work there. And people say, oh, well, wait, you know, beyond the subconscious, there is the unconscious. So I'm wondering if your research into quantum physics has turned up anything of interest to share about that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the unconscious, it's a kind of unique level of mind, because it's both the place where these higher archetypes from the higher dimensions filter down through us, where we get many of our ideals of what it means to be good, what it means to be fulfilled. But by the same token, it's also a repository of the shadow of our, you know, unresolved issues and you know, darker side, which coincides with what the Gnostics said, that there's a psychic realm where there's a little bit of a tug and pull between enlightenment and ignorance, and that plays out down here in our world, and it often plays out through our subconscious minds. The more we can bring the contents of our subconscious into our consciousness, the more we heal ourselves, the more we become what Jung called actuated human beings. And part of that process of becoming an actuated human being and getting to the point where you can delve into the subconscious and maybe use it to, you know, control your destiny more than letting it control you, is by merging your intuitive and your rational side. So Jung told us that every human being has the male and the female in them, the anima and the animus, the male and the female, and the female and the male. And Jung said that the more we bring those into harmony, we become actuated human beings, we become, you know, superior human beings. And this is exactly what Jesus said in the Gnostic Gospel of Thomas a couple thousand years ago. He said, when you make the male into the female, into the female into the male, and the two become one, then you will realize the kingdom of heaven, then you will move mountains. So what he was really saying is that if we bring our intuition and our rationality into some kind of a working balance, that things start to open up for us, we start to have realizations. The path that we take, which is the, you know, the gateway to higher consciousness. I think that explains a lot of the psychological part of this equation.
Yeah, I think the true mysticism moves beyond all of that. So many people that have invented or discovered amazing things, it came to them in that space between. It wasn't necessarily from homework they had done. And I'm not saying you don't have to make an effort in a direction you want to go in, but I just hold this thing about mysticism being beyond all the mind stuff. I just really see it as separate, like soul and mind. How do you see them?
Well, it's a really interesting question. Look, let's look at Albert Einstein. Albert Einstein intuited a lot of the information that led to his famous theories. But by the same token, after he intuited it, he had to back it up with the good old equations. So there is an example of using your intuitive and your rational minds in harmony to come up with some astounding information that has to do with the very way that our reality operates. And I think that I liken it to this. I say, you know, the play between intuition and the play between analytical rationality is like a rocket ship, okay? The intuition is like the fuel system in a rocket. You need intuition to give you the initial insights to launch you off the ground into the right direction. But once you're off the ground, if you don't have the guidance system, you're going to go around in circles. By the same token, if you have the guidance system, but you don't have the fuel or the intuition, you never get off the ground in the first place. So there is an intentionality that you can enter into with your rational mind to help direct your intuitional nature to lead you to making discoveries that will really help you. And I often say to people, an interesting exercise I often tell people to do is when you're meditating, think of sitting in a chair opposite a person who you really admire. Now, it could be Albert Einstein, it could be a Nobel Prize winner, whoever it is, and you have questions that you want to ask them. And the questions you want to ask them often determine who you're sitting across the chair from.
Of course.
But you literally have a conversation with them. You set your intention, you pose your questions, and then you listen. As you listen to what they have to say, it's a tool that you're using to speak to yourself, to speak to your higher conscious self, where you can get information. But, you know, it's a legitimate device because what's the tarot? What are card readings? What are anything like that?
Sure.
Those are just tools.
Vehicles,
to speak to yourself or to speak to your higher consciousness.
Yeah, totally agree there. So you have a chapter in your book, Peter, titled Quantum Weirdness. What is the weirdest quantum thing you've encountered either personally or through your research?
Well, I mean, just the entire world is weird because think of it for a second. We think of this world as solid. You look around the room, you're sitting in a chair, you knock on your desk, you open a door. I mean, these are all perceptions we have that there's a solid world. But there's a contradiction there because we also know that all those things are composed of subatomic particles, which are in constant motion, and they're not solid, and they have lots of space between them. And yet that world gives rise to a world that appears solid. So right away, you know there's some contradiction here at play. There's some illusion going on because there's one thing that is a reality and there's another thing that's an appearance and they don't jive. So just that simple fact alone, there's a lot of weird things in the quantum world that don't make sense in our way of looking at it in terms of physical consciousness. There's something called quantum entanglement, which means that subatomic particles, which are the equivalent of literally light years away in planetary terms, literally light years away, communicate with each other instantaneously, faster than the speed of light. So that's like if there's a version of you here on Earth and then there's another version of you here on Mars, if I pinch the version of you here on Earth and the Mars version went ouch at the exact same instant, how does that happen? You're not connected by fiber optics, right? So what's the medium that actually allows these things to happen? There's many counterintuitive things that happen in the quantum world that we just can't explain in macrocosmic terms. And yet, when you really get down to the nitty-gritty of reality, we think of our solid world as being composed of particles, of subatomic particles. But here's the other weird thing. There's no such thing as subatomic particles. I mean, at the very basis of reality, there are no particles. What there is are waves of energy. There are energy fields. There's waves of quantum energy. And at some point during these waves of quantum energy, somehow these waves collapse into what appear to be particle formations that give rise to our material world. So I know that's hard to understand, so let me give an analogy. I live in Florida part of the year, and we have something called water spouts here. And what water spouts are basically they're waterborne little mini tornadoes. You can actually see them rising out of the water. They're like swirls of water that look exactly like a tornado. So you have the smooth body of water, like, say, a smooth river, which would be the analogy of the quantum field, the quantum energy field. And then out of that smooth body of water arises this disruption, this temporary disruption of a waterspout. The waterspout, in a way, is kind of an illusion, because really what it is, it's part of the water that forms a particular state and goes back in that particular state. But that's what our physical reality is. We're like kind of a blip or a blemish in the quantum field that arises temporarily, and that eventually will go back into that quantum field temporarily. So, you know, they're very hard things for the typical mind to really understand. But what it all has to do with is the fact that, in all honesty, we're living in a simulation. We're living in a simulated reality that our conscious minds perceive as being physical, but in reality, they are energetic manifestations, almost like hologrammatic projections that form our perception of physical reality. And I don't want to get too deep into this, because this would be a major discussion, but the whole idea of living in a holographic simulation is a body of theory that started off back in the 50s, started off over this whole trying to solve this puzzle of quantum entanglement I spoke of, where two particles instantaneously communicate far distances apart. But then it was reinforced by studies of how black holes operate. And the bottom line is, the conclusion that they're coming to in all this study is that we appear to actually be more like a holographic projection coming from somewhere than a separate reality in and of ourselves.
Yes, yes. And also an interesting piece to all of that, and we don't have to go into depth about this, the part that the observer plays in all of this. So it certainly allows for many, many differing realities.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like this. All reality stems from one source of consciousness, one, what I call, you can call it the force, you can call it God, you can call it the source, doesn't matter, it's all the same thing.
Right, yes.
An intelligent consciousness projecting itself through light energy is what has formed all of reality, including us. Now, we are kind of like relay stations. If you understand how a power grid operates, you have the source of the power, and then it goes through various relays to be stepped down in energy in order to become useful and create the energy that we use in our homes and, you know, in our commercial enterprises and everything else. We are kind of like the relay stations. We are consciousness ourselves in a diluted form, in a limited form, that basically has projected a type of simulation or reality that we believe ourselves to be physical beings, when what we really are is conscious energy projected into an illusion of physicality. And another analogy I can give to understand this, because this stuff gets pretty abstract and trippy, so you always have to bring it down to something that people can understand. If you remember the old Star Trek series, there was something called the holodeck on the starship, and the crew used to go down there, and essentially it was this incredible virtual reality program where they could project themselves into any historical period under any conditions, and they had these characters in it that were so real that the crew could actually interact with them. They could enter this hologrammatic field and be like one of the characters in the hologram. We're kind of like the same way. We're the programmers that forgot we're the programmers because we identify with our own projections.
Right.
So it's kind of really the way that was a very interesting thing they had in Star Trek, because what they had really tapped into was the way that reality works.
Yes, yes. So we're quickly leaning in the direction of truth is stranger than fiction.
Yeah, I think that would be a pretty good umbrella description.
Yeah. So, Peter, where do you leave off from your book, Quantum Spirituality? Is there one takeaway to mention now, or is there something that you envision or have gotten feedback about?
Well, if you're asking in terms of feedback from the people that have read Quantum Spirituality, the feedback that I'm getting, and a lot of this is on the reviews that you'll see in Amazon, which are mostly five-star reviews, the feedback that I'm really getting is that the whole multidisciplinary approach, from using quantum physics, ancient spiritual wisdom, Jungian psychology, neurobiology, and things like that, to portray how the creation happened, how reality operates through various dimensions of existence and everything else. The feedback that I'm getting is, wow, it's really opened my eyes to connect all these dots, because I knew little bits and pieces of this, or they were in my subconscious, or I've read about them, but I never really saw a cohesive framework that put it all together and show how all these things overlap to point in a unified direction. And it's inspired people to better be equipped to make their own spiritual journey in consciousness, whether they do it by meditation or whatever means that people use. And that was exactly the point that I was trying to get to when I wrote the book, which is to give people a roadmap to help on their own spiritual journey to have extraordinary experiences with higher consciousness. They'll have to have their own spiritual practice in order to do it, but they have a tremendous arena of information in which to operate now, in order to be inspired, in order to understand, you know what, there is a payoff here at the end of the day. If I really continue my spiritual pursuits, there really is a payoff here, because there is a higher reality, and I'm moving towards that higher reality. That's the takeaway, and that's the feedback that I'm getting from people who have come in contact with the book.
On a non-intellectual or collaborative information level, what do you do in your spiritual practice?
Well, you know, the funny thing is, I probably used to meditate more than I do, because I find that my revelations or my insights now kind of come to me while I'm still conscious. If I set my mind to something and I just shut my eyes, not go into a trance thing like Edgar Cayce did, but if I just shut my eyes, I get those insights. So I got to the point where my meditations kind of bled into my conscious mind. I think that does happen.
Definitely.
After a period.
Absolutely.
If you're really diligent about it, your meditative level leads into your conscious level. So you're starting to break down the barriers between, here's my consciousness that's in contact with the five senses, and I used to operate, you know, my everyday waking type of chores and everything else with my deeper insight type of mind, down at the delta level of brain waves or whatever.
Right.
They kind of start to bleed into one another.
Absolutely.
So you get these insights, sometimes while I'm watching TV.
Obviously, there's so much that you've written about and so much that isn't in the book that is peripheral that you could share. Is there anything else you would like to leave us with today before we close?
Well, yeah, I'd like to tell people, please visit my website, petercanova.com. There's a wealth of information, articles, videos, quantum spirituality that just swept the American Book Fest Best Book Awards. And there's a trilogy that I wrote called The First Souls Trilogy, about the first spirit consciousness to incarnate into the physical material world. It's a geopolitical spiritual thriller, and we're working to get the first book into a TV series now.
You know, Peter, as a PS, I have to definitely thank you that you've done all of us a favor explaining quantum physics in a nutshell, and Max Planck would be very proud, I think.
I would hope so. I love Max Planck. But the trick really was to take these arcane spiritual texts and quantum physics, which is really, really a mind blower for people, and make them understandable
right.
to the general public. That's probably the biggest task that I had. And from the feedback I'm getting, it seems like a lot of people are getting there.
Yes, you're really zeroing in on where the public is, winning all these book awards. That's a true sign, I would have to say.
Yeah, from that standpoint, you're right. It's gratifying, not so much from an ego standpoint, but it's gratifying from the fact that people are understanding and relating to it, which was always my big concern. Writing is a solitary
yes.
endeavor, and you're sitting there and nobody's over your shoulder saying, yeah, you know, I understand that. That's a good way to put it. Yeah, you do your best and you put it out there, and you really keep your fingers crossed that it's relatable to people.
Many thanks to Peter Canova for sharing his book, Quantum Spirituality. We're at tributariesradio.wordpress.com and also on your favorite podcasting platform. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.